Hello everyone, it's time to read the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, February 24th. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone, glad to have you listening as always. We're having a nice day, the sun finally showed up to do some more melting in the Fort Dodge area, and gradually all that extra snow we've been having this winter is slowly melting away. Pardon the sound of the rustling newspaper, we'll go ahead and get things going today. The Need for Speed is the title of the first article in today's Messenger. Fort Dodge residents could have an eye-popping internet download speed of 10 gigabits, courtesy of a proposed broadband municipal utility. Construction of that system could begin in 2022, according to officials, in a process that began with the City Council strategic planning session about 3 years ago, planning for a utility that would provide residents and businesses with another option for internet services continues to advance. We are going to have a fast and reliable broadband system, said City Manager David Fierk. City voters gave the local government the authority to pursue such a system during a November 2019 referendum, with 71.6% of them voting yes. What is proposed is a full municipal fiber to the premises system, said Ryan Mayle, the assistant to the city manager, who is the project manager for the broadband initiative. He said the fiber optic cables needed for the system would extend all the way to a home or business. The system would cost $26 to $35 million, depending on how many people sign up to get the service. Having large numbers of people sign up would drive up the cost, according to Mayle. If you sell more broadband, you need more fiber in the ground, he said. Officials hope to get a better grasp of how many potential customers there are during a pre-registration event to be held this summer. Studies completed so far have estimated that 4 out of every 10 households will sign up for the service. Fierk said the figure is pretty conservative, one that has been used in the financial modeling for the project. Municipal broadband customers will have 3 options for download and upload speeds: 100 megabytes, 1 gigabit, or 10 gigabits. Prices for those levels of services haven't been determined yet. They will be very competitive to our marketplace, Mayle said. Revenue from whatever fees are eventually established will pay for the system. The plan is to borrow the money in the form of revenue bonds and then pay off that debt with some income generated by the system. Currently, the consulting firm Howard R. Green Company of Cedar Rapids is doing what is called a mid-level design for the system. The design will show where cables would run and where the system's nodes would be located. Mayle said the nodes would be metal boxes where the fiber optic cables would come in and be split in multiple directions. Just how much fiber optic cable will be needed isn't known yet, but Fierk said it will be a lot. The City Council still has a number of decisions to make to actually launch the new utility. If the Council forges ahead, construction would start in the spring of 2022. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, we've been reading numerous stories over the past week or so of the murder trial in Webster City for Zachary Bassett. A second-degree murder verdict was returned, and he was found guilty. That is the article that we'll read next. A Hamilton County jury convicted Zachary Bassett of second-degree murder Tuesday in the September 2018 killing of Andrea Sokolowski. Deliberation started afternoon on Tuesday after 10 days at trial, including 2 days of jury selection. The jury verdict was returned around 4 o'clock. Bassett was charged with first-degree murder after Sokolowski was found unresponsive at the couple's apartment in Webster City. The jury also had the options of second-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, assault causing bodily injury, and assault. First-degree murder would have required the jury to be convinced of premeditation, deliberation, and specific intent, which state attorneys argued was present by the very nature of Sokolowski's death. Asphyxiation by strangulation requires several minutes of sustained, consistent pressure to cause death. The second-degree murder verdict meant that the jury believed Bassett assaulted Sokolowski with malice and aforethought the night she died, causing her death, but without the specific intent and premeditation elements required to clench a first-degree verdict. The penalty for second-degree murder is up to 50 years in prison, at least 35 of which must be served before becoming eligible for parole. But even without a mandatory life in prison sentence, Sokolowski's family was satisfied with the verdict. Obviously, we wanted first degree, but we're happy with it still, said Jared Foster, Sokolowski's son. It's basically a life sentence in a way. Bassett, aged 34, will not be eligible for parole until he is at least 67, assuming he receives credit for time served in jail awaiting trial. But as the victim's family reflected on justice, they acknowledged a life sentence doled out to them outside of the court's discretion. I feel like I have a parallel life sentence in a different way, said Aaron Sokolowski, Andrea's ex-husband, who supported her after their divorce and through her abusive relationship with Bassett. While 35 to 50 years in prison will never be enough justice for the woman they loved, they said it will be enough to let them begin to grieve after nearly 2.5 years in suspense. It will mean, hopefully, a lot of healing, finally crying and finally accepting, said Denise McKnight, the victim's daughter. I still feel like she's going to walk through the door or call me laughing. You know, McKnight said as her voice broke, I haven't been able to let go and heal from it. She's gone forever. After being forced to tear open a wound that had never healed with trial exhibits, they still remember Andrea for her infectious laugh, her smile, and her positive attitude, no matter how difficult times were. She was a very unique person, said her ex-husband. That kind of person doesn't come around very often. It was with those smiles and laughs, they said, through which she put on a brave face, choosing to live with the man who confirmed her worst fears. In the months preceding her death, she told friends she feared for her life with her boyfriend. In the weeks leading up to her death, friends and family told her accounts of being pinned down and muffled to the point of passing out. After Bassett was arrested for domestic abuse assault in August 2018, the family said they enjoyed a few weeks of reprieve while she remained out of his grip. But as his threats against the family mounted, they said she eventually chose to live with him again, something the defense highlighted with her request to discontinue a no-contact order. She, at the end, went back to protect all of us, said Aaron. She was a brave person to do that, self-sacrifice her life for everybody else. And after the unthinkable happened, he said that Andrea could have been any of them at the hands of Bassett, knowing he would be excoriated by defense attorneys combing through the divorce decree. He showed up at a trial to secure justice for her. There, defense attorneys harped on the times the family falsely accused her husband of domestic abuse assault. It was just what I had to do. It was for her. I had to get her justice, Aaron said. I never stopped loving her. The state's argument balanced its strength on an abundance of pinpoint petechia hemorrhages, a sign of strangulation, and text messages between the victim and her killer the night of her death. Their closing argument underscored Bassett's loss of control towards the end of the relationship. Her final texts, less than 2 hours before she was reported unresponsive, told Bassett that she was ending the relationship. Bassett's sentencing hearing is scheduled for April 6th. Take a look next at From Our Files. There's a picture in today's Messenger of Braxton Clint, then aged 5, as she gets eye to eye with Dottie West, a shipper key belonging to Rusty Nelson of Fort Dodge. Pat Saunders' dog Charlie is also in the picture and is a Boston Terrier and takes an interest in something on the other side of the room. Local Head Start program children watched obedience as well as search and rescue demonstrations at the Fort Dodge Kennel Club. This week's Messenger poll question, do you think early voting should be reduced in Iowa? To render an answer, go to messengernews.net. The Messenger poll is updated weekly. Answers and new questions will be published on Saturdays. Looking at this date in history, it is February 24th, the 55th day of 2021. There are 310 days left in the year. On this date in 1868, the United States House of Representatives impeached President Andrew Johnson by a vote of 126 to 47 following his attempted dismissal of Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton. Johnson was later acquitted by the Senate. In 1803, in the Marbury v. Madison decision, the Supreme Court established judicial review with the constitutionality of statutes. In 1815, American engineer and inventor Robert Fulton, credited with building the first successful commercial steamboat, died in New York at age 49. In 1938, the first nylon bristle toothbrush, manufactured by DuPont under the name Dr. West's Miracle Toothbrush, went on sale. In 1942, the SS Struma, a charter ship attempting to carry nearly 800 Jewish refugees from Romania to British-mandated Palestine, was torpedoed by a Soviet submarine in the Black Sea. All but one of the refugees perished. In 1961, the Federal Communications Commission authorized the nation's first full-scale trial of pay television in Hartford, Connecticut. In 1981, a jury in White Plains, New York, found Gene Harris guilty of second-degree murder in the fatal shooting of Scarsdale Diet author Dr. Herman Tarnauer, sentenced to 15 years to life in prison. Harris was granted clemency by New York Governor Mario Cuomo in December 1992. In 1988, in a ruling that expanded legal protections for parody and satire, the Supreme Court unanimously overturned a $150,000 award that the Reverend Jerry Falwell had won against Hustler magazine and its publisher Larry Flint. In 1996, Cuba downed two small American planes operated by the Group Brothers to the rescue that claim were violating Cuban airspace. All four pilots were killed. In 2008, Cuba's parliament named Raul Castro president, ending nearly 50 years of rule by his brother Fidel. In 2015, the Justice Department announced that George Zimmerman, the former Neighborhood Watch volunteer who fatally shot Trayvon Martin in a 2012 confrontation, would not face federal charges. 10 years ago, Discovery, the world's most traveled spaceship, thundered into orbit for the final time, heading toward the International Space Station on a journey marking the beginning of the end of the shuttle era. And that is from this date in history. We'll take a look next from the Webster City Freeman Journal. Tax asking to stay the same. The taxation rate has not changed in 6 years. The Van Deese Medical Center Board of Trustees voted to keep the hospital's tax asking the same for the coming year. The board met Tuesday night in a virtual format. A public hearing on the tax asking was held at the start of the board meeting. Chief Financial Officer Alice Heinrich said that the taxation rate as proposed would remain the same as it has been for the past 6 years at $2.10 per thousand in valuation. With the 3.5% increase in county property valuations, the amount to be raised by taxation is $2.177,966 million. This would fund 6% of our proposed expenditures for 2022, Heinrichs told the trustees. She said, with the addition of $38,945 in estimated utility tax replacement excise tax, the total tax revenues will increase by more than $74,000, moving the total revenue to just over $2.2 million. Heinrich said that compared to other Iowa hospitals that are organized to levy for tax revenues, Van Deese Medical Center ranks 20th of 43. This means that 19 hospitals in the state have higher rates per thousand evaluation than we do, she said. With regard to the total county tax appropriations for 2020, VDMC had about 7% of the total county tax dollars that Heinrich said funded about 6% of the hospital's expenditures. The school receives 39% of the taxation, while the county receives 33% and the city 17%, according to Heinrichs. The hospital provides the county with EMS service and is not fully reimbursed for the service, Heinrichs said, as a reason for maintaining the current tax asking. We also continue to evaluate what consumers need in the community to expand or add additional services, she said. This comes with those additional startup expenses relating to new equipment, staffing of providers, and clinical staff. We continue to need the tax funding to offset costs for services, especially FICA and IPRS benefit costs. Heinrich said the federal deficits and state budget cuts for Medicaid and Medicare are funding trickles down to the local hospital in the form of smaller reimbursements. Chairman Carol Oss said it was the recommendation of the Finance Committee to keep the tax asking at the current level. The board unanimously approved the 2021-2022 tax asking. The Conference Board of Hamilton County declined to approve a 4% wage increase for staff in the Hamilton County Assessor's Office, but decided on a split move to approve a 2.75% increase, the same amount approved for other county workers, and added a stipend for the Chief Deputy Assessor. The board met Tuesday in the Board of Supervisors conference room. The board is composed of the supervisors, mayors from around the county, and representatives of the county's school boards. The group meets to approve the assessor's budget for the coming year, and after a public hearing, acts on adopting the budget. Assessor Kevin Barenfuss presented his budget and proposed the 4% wage hike for himself and Assistant Assessor Lindsay Burkhart, along with a 6.5% increase for Deputy Assessor John Daniels and an 8% increase for Chief Deputy Assessor Bo Crystal. Barenfuss said the additional amount for Crystal was to bring his salary more in line with similar positions across the state. As you recall, several years ago, we were required to name a chief deputy. His wage was far below what most chief deputies, let alone chief deputies in the state, were making, Barenfuss told the board. You asked me not to raise him up at that time, but to do it over a period of time. That's why his is that way. Barenfuss said Daniel's wage increase was due to his increased responsibilities, and so he can do as much appraisal in the field as possible to save on hiring an outside appraisal service. Supervisor Rick Young said he objected to the size of the wage increases. Deputies and the sheriff are making 2.75% increases, and they are locked in for that for the next 3 years, said Young. We've got people with secondary roads that are out in the snowstorms clearing snow, and they're getting 2.75%. That's just unfair to all employees if some are getting 8% or 4%. Young said Tuesday's meeting represented the third time he'd been involved with the conference board meetings and that he wasn't going to keep my mouth shut anymore. Young said the increases in the assessor's office have been set at 4% over the past 5 years. The initial vote increases on the increases failed to receive a majority. Supervisor Jerry Clobbernant said he had talked with Barenfuss earlier in the week about the wages. It's hard to go out to all the employees throughout the system and tell them they are getting 2.75% increase when they know other departments are getting 8%. I don't have a problem with doing a one-time $5,000 stipend for Bo to get him to that point because of the responsibilities that he has. The budget was approved with 2.75% increases for Barenfuss, Daniels, and Burkhart, and a $5,000 stipend for Crystal, with four board members voting against. A public hearing will be held on March 9th at noon in the supervisor's boardroom on the assessor's budget. The Webster City School Board heard the initial contract proposals from the two school unions Monday night. The board met in person at the school administration building, and the public was able to join the meeting via Zoom. Trish Barenfuss, representing the Webster City Education Association, read a statement on behalf of the teachers' union before offering the proposal to the board. I want to take a moment to acknowledge the challenges we have faced this school year. The past months have been unlike anything any of us have ever expected. We realize that our proposal cannot take us back to life before the pandemic, just as we realize that granting this will not immediately remove the challenges we will continue to face with COVID-19. Barenfuss said the teaching staff said the contract request would serve as a means to acknowledge, quote, the hard work and hard and impressive work union members have put in during the pandemic to provide the best education possible for area students. To our association, this process is much more than just salary and benefits. It is ensuring we have the best and brightest educators working for our students. It is ensuring that our students have the best possible environment to reach their highest potential. It is ensuring all of us as professionals are treated as such, she said. Barenfuss said working together through the pandemic has helped everyone deal with these issues and the uncertainties. It is our hope that we continue to work in that same manner to reach an agreement that acknowledges the work our members have done and continue to do on behalf of their students and the community, she said. The teacher's proposal called for a 5.11% total package increase including a base increase of $1,200. The proposal also suggested a one-year contract term. The board also reviewed the initial proposal by the Webster City Educational Services Association. The proposal calls for a 75-cent wage increase on base for food services, secretaries, paraeducators, and custodial workers, with a $75 increase for bus drivers. The proposal also calls for all staff to advance a step for the 2021-2022 school year. Dr. Mandy Ross, superintendent, said the board would respond to the initial proposals during the March 9th board meeting. Public hearing will be held March 8th at 6 o'clock concerning the issuance of sales, service, and use tax revenue bonds in the amount of $1,920,000 for the school infrastructure project that would remodel, repair, and improve Pleasant Valley and Sunset Heights Elementary School, including HVAC improvements. Though the hearing was being held via Zoom, Ross said the chat option will be monitored in case any member of the public would like to comment during the hearing. This really pertains to taking a loan against our 1% sales tax bond, to put it into layman's terms, Ross said. The board set the hearing date and also approved a letter of agreement with Piper Sandler, the firm that will serve as the placement agent or underwriter for the bonds. A letter of agreement was also approved with Allers Cooney Law Firm, who will oversee the legalities of the bond processes are followed. Elementary principals Mindy Mossman, Kelly Rice, and Jessica Hector gave a report on elementary enrollment plans for next school year. We want to make sure we're using our additional learning center. We are fortunate to add Northeast Hamilton in 2019, so as we plan ahead, we're looking at how we can get the word out that we have classes at Northeast Hamilton also, said Mossman, principal of Pleasant View Elementary. The principal said they would like to see balanced enrollment across all three centers, Pleasant View, Sunset Heights, and Northeast Hamilton. The proposal included planning for 5 sections of kindergarten at Pleasant View and 2 sections at Northeast Hamilton, 5 sections of first grade at Pleasant View, 2 sections of first grade at Northeast Hamilton, 5 sections of second grade at Sunset Heights, and 2 sections of second grade at Northeast Hamilton. That's how we could balance everything out and take advantage of our space and use each building to its maximum potential, Mossman said. The principal said they would be sending out information on the 3 learning centers and hope to gain insights from families about which center they would like their children to attend. This is not registration, it's only indicating preference, said Kelly Rice, principal at Sunset Heights. The district will provide a Google form for parents to fill out on their computer, or there's a QR code on the parent information that will allow them to fill out the form on a smartphone. First Congregational United Church of Christ in Webster City is seeking donations of good used t-shirts for a project. The shirts will be used for a service project to make tote bags. Food Bank of Iowa is asking people to make shopping bags from t-shirts. The tote bag will need to hold up to 30 pounds of cans, bags of rice or beans, potatoes, and other items. Organizers said worn-out t-shirts, tees with holes or that are thin or gauzy texture will not work. For more information, contact Sherry Lexel at mrslexel@gmail.com. Lexel will take donations to a group of people who will sew the bags and will then take the bags to All Cultures Equal of the Food Bank of Iowa. Take a look next at the lifestyle section. Students in the arts have been announced for the winter terms. Kindergarten through 12th grade students in Webster City Community School District have been recognized for excellence by their instructors for winter term in the performing and visual arts programs at their 5 school buildings. At Northeast Hamilton Elementary in Art, Seth Hook, Inevea Arellano, Adrian Ramos, Lily Moreland, Kendra Cole, Pryor Taylor, and Rosemary Chamness. Recipients in art at Northeast Hamilton Elementary. In music, Sophia Lopez, Case Yeager, Naya Wagner, Hayden Tapper, Hayden Keene, Emma Thompson, Lovey Prusman. From Prairie View Elementary in art, Tinley Turner, Hadley Johnson, Donnie Change, Kariana Sambong, Lake and the Schnitzer, and Albert Bautista. In music, Jamie Candelario, Oliva Fisher, Lauren Ean, Landry Petersburg, Cohen Brim, Charlie Christensen. Sunset Heights Elementary in art, Catherine Hickok, Aspen Berkey, Maya Wong, Tiffany Noriega Borjas, Lexi Khalit, Vanessa Larinaga Rodriguez, Harper Riley, Diana Fernandez Rodriguez. In music, Brecken Moss, Haley Anderson, Kennedy Olmsted, Addie Thompson, Cameron Tofty, Reed Larson, Sadie Rippentrop, and Kendra Schultz. In middle school, vocal band and art. In art, Briley Van Deer, Ariana Reed, Jasmine Venegas, and Kale Nixon. In band, Evie Davis, Isabel Grossamy, Jackson Meyer, Colton Schrader. In choirs, vocal and general music, Owen Anderson, Ephraim Callis, Arniaz, Sylvia Otterus, and Gabe Ruby. In high school, Webster City High School vocal music, Shaylin McKee, Andrew Poulos, Tucker Murray, Echo Bearden. In band, Cody Sizer, Rory Sneffen, Allison Oswald, Kyle Shane. In art, Sasha Hayden, Anastasia Iverson, Zach Dyvig, Kaylin Butts. And in theater, Anastasia Iverson, Shelby Queen, Jack Lahr, and Alyssa Delaney. Those are the students in the arts winners from Webster City Schools. St. Thomas Knights are going to host a fish fry. Knights of Columbus of St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church will host a series of drive-through fish fry dinners during Lent. The events are scheduled for February 19th, which is past, March 5th, March 19th, from 5:15 to 6:30 at the St. Thomas Aquinas Parish Center, 1000 Des Moines Street. The menu will include flaky fried fish, crispy French fries, coleslaw, tartar sauce, and dessert. The cost of the meal is $10. The public is invited to take part. Webster City Rotary donated to Meals on Wheels recently. Picture in the Webster City Freeman Journal shows Kathy Johnston accepting a $500 donation on behalf of the Webster City Meals on Wheels program from Kyle Heffernan, president of the Webster City Rotary Club. In an editorial from the Webster City Freeman Journal, new production facility is positive development for Webster City. That is the title of an editorial in the Webster City Freeman Journal. Natural Shrimp Incorporated has taken over the assets of Alder Aqua, formerly Vero Blue Farms. This is a positive development for Webster City and will bring many good-paying jobs to the community. It also repurposes existing industrial properties so that they are back on the tax rolls. The facilities will use city utilities and bring other economic benefits to the community. The proprietary technology used in their production process cleans and recirculates wastewater, which means less wear and tear on city infrastructure. The publicly traded Texas-based company expects to produce thousands of pounds of shrimp each week once the facility goes to full production capacity in the first half of 2021. A subsidiary, Natural Aquatic Systems, adapts the computer company's technology to other species of fish and shellfish. They anticipate being able to provide products to the entire Midwest from this one plant. The Webster City plant will be the second production facility for the company. The other one is located in La Costa, Texas. The market for shrimp in the United States alone is 1.7 billion pounds, making it by far the most popular seafood. Aquaculture, like natural shrimps, is better for the environment as it does not require the high levels of antibiotics and other chemicals required for farmed shrimp, nor does it create the environmental impacts of trawling. The Daily Freeman Journal welcomes the latest addition to the city's employers and wishes them every success. We hope that once the factory is up and running, that Webster City will be able to add shrimp production to the list of quality products for which the city is known. You're listening to the Ford Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind, and it is time to look at today's obituary page. Jerique Bryson. Jerique J. Bryson, 24, of Fort Dodge, died February 14th at his home. Services will be 11 a.m. Saturday, February 27th at Lighthouse Ministries Church with Kelly Moore officiating. Burial will fall at North Lawn Cemetery. Visitation 4 to 7 Friday, at Laufisweiler's funeral home. Jerique is survived by his parents, Vanessa Gully and Jermaine Bryson, daughter Zariah Bryson, and his significant other, Kelsey Jones, siblings Monique Gully and Cameron Carradine, Tyreek Bryson, Yonique Gully, My Yonique Gully, Darian Green, Bryson Gobelli, Duran Foy, Tyron Gully, and Devontae Foy, grandparents Elaine Gully, and Booker T. Bryson, and many aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, and friends. He was preceded in death by his grandmother, Betty Bryson, and brothers DeQuelis Poe, Etienne Burns, and James Starr. Jerique Jermaine Recco Bryson was born November 15, 1996, in Fort Dodge. He attended area schools and graduated with his GED in 2016. Jerique enjoyed spending time with his family and friends, especially his daughter. He started a clothing line named Adore and loved shopping and traveling. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Ron Stratemeyer. From Eagle Grove, visitation for Ron Stratemeyer, 71, of Eagle Grove, will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, February 25th, at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. From Rolin, Gary Taylor. Gary Taylor of Rolin died Saturday, February 20th. A private gathering will be held from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock Thursday for the family at Gunderson Funeral Home. An obituary is available at GundersonFuneralHome.com. From Lakeview, Susie Huss. Services for Susie Huss, 71, of Lakeview, will be 11 a.m. Friday, February 26th at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Wall Lake. Visitation is 9 to 11 on Friday at the church. Farber Ottoman Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. And that is the extent of today's obituary page. We'll take a look next at the sports section in today's Messenger. Back on Track is the title of the first article about Iowa Central Volleyball. Molly McCauley found herself thrust into the starting lineup Tuesday night for the 8th-ranked Iowa Central Volleyball team in Fort Dodge. McCauley, a former Algona High School standout, recorded 8 digs, 3 serving aces, 2 block assists, and a kill in helping the Tritons rebound from their first loss of the season with a sweep over Northeast inside Hodges Fieldhouse. Scores were 25-21, 25-23, and 25-18. I was very excited to be able to step on the court with my teammates, McCauley said. I felt nervous at first, but I was very thankful for my teammates to keep reassuring me throughout the game. It was very rewarding for me as I tried to go into practice every day to get the team and myself better. It is most definitely a good night to leave with a win in 3. McCauley finished off the win in the second set with an ace as Iowa Central, 10-1 for the season, erased a 7-0 deficit. She started the third with a kill as part of a 9-4 run to begin the action. We know what Molly is capable of, said Iowa Central head coach Sarah Horn. We played her against DMAC and she did very well. She really stepped up and had a nice night. Caitlin Steffes led the Tritons with 23 kills and 6 digs, while Keely Anderson added 9 kills and 11 digs. Angel Baylark recorded 8 kills, Haley Alherithy had 6, and Alicia Johnson had 39 assists. I thought we had a slow finish to the first set that carried over into the second, Horn said, but we were able to regroup and figure things out on the court. We had trouble doing that against DMAC, so that was good to see. Iowa Central had its 9-match win streak snapped at the hands of the 4th-ranked Bears last week. The Tritons did earn a sweep over DMAC back in January at home, where they are now 52-10 since the start of the 2016 season. Steffes and Anderson each added an ace, with former Algona prep Baylen Johnson recording 19 digs and 2 assists. Alicia Johnson had 11 digs, Alherithy 4 block assists with a solo block. For the Hawks, 3-10 for the season, Peyton Weber had 11 kills and Carly Hirsch 9. Iowa Central is back in action when they head to Indian Hills, who are 3-5 for the season. This will be Wednesday night, beginning at 6 o'clock. So presumably in Thursday's paper, we should have those results. Dodger boys riding momentum, feeling confident as the state tournament is up next. That is for the bowling team. Nick Benson knows he has all the plate pieces for another run at a boys' state title in bowling. Three competitors return from last year's championship team, including 2020 individual gold medalist Caleb Anderson. The senior and classmate Brady Graves, along with sophomore Carson Warning, were part of Fort Dodge's second-ever championship bowling squad last season. "We just want to go down and set a tone," Benson said, who is in the third season at the helm. "If we bowl the way we are capable of, we should be right in the mix." The Dodgers will begin the state tournament at 8:30 at Cadillac Lanes in Waterloo. Seniors Kyle Davis and Mitchell Bolton will have entered the mix in 2021. Juniors Christian Miller and Jace Ulrich are also pieces to the rotation. The Dodgers rolled a 33-03 to claim gold a year ago, while Anderson won the individual crown with a 546 series. Davis came up big for the Dodgers at districts, winning the individual crown with a 513 series. He had games of 259 and 278. On the season, Davis had a 397 series average. He was near perfection earlier in the season, rolling a 298. "Kyle knows what it takes," Vincent said. "He has the physical and mental skills. He has a great routine and executes and is super consistent." Kyle's mental evolution has been incredible. Anderson, a four-time state qualifier, carries a 461 average. "It's been great to have the seniors around and understand what it takes to bowl good numbers," Benson said. Caleb is a strong bowler who has been in this situation before. Graves, who was 13th a year ago, has been consistent for the Dodgers with a 388 average. "You know, Brady's always going to be right around 400, Benson said. "He never strays too far, and you don't have to worry about him. Brady is as good as anybody putting the ball down in the same spot." Warning was a 15th as a freshman at state. He is currently sporting a 364 average. "Carson is always there when it matters most. He can really turn it on," said Vincent. "He has learned to slow down and has worked on becoming a better bowler. He is a huge asset to the program." Bolton, a 381 average, Miller, 350, and Ulrich, 335, have all stepped up and led at times as well. "Mitchell has put in a lot of time. He has the physical skills and has gotten better at being the best he can be," Benson said. "Christian and Jace have worked hard this year. They have been in and out of the lineup along with Jade Ray and Brady Dodge. They've come up big for us in key moments as well." Heading back to the main page of the sports section of the Messenger. Garrigan and Newell Fonda are one step away again from state tournament. "Ever since the final whistle of last year's Class 1A girls state tournament, talk of a rematch has been lingering. Top-ranked Bishop Garrigan girls, number 2 Newell Fonda, met for the state championship last March. The two programs appear to be on another collision course and both play in Class 1A regional championships on Wednesday. Garrigan, 22-1 overall, faces BCLUW, 15-9 on the season, in Mason City in a Region 1 matchup. Newell Fonda, 22-1, takes on CAM, 17-6 on the season at Green County High School for a Region 2 title. Tip is set for 7 o'clock at both sites. In the 2020 final, the Golden Bears held a 54-40 lead heading into the fourth quarter. The Mustangs outscored Garrigan 25-9 in the final frame for a 65-63 win. Newell Fonda has only one loss this year, reeling off 18 straight games since losing to the Golden Bears in the fifth game of the year, 66-45. The Mustangs are led by four players in double figures: senior Bailey Sievers, 13.7, junior Macy Sievers, 13, seniors Maggie Walker and Ellen Larson, both at 12.2, are right behind. For CAM, freshman Eva Stevenson is scoring 10.9 points per game. Garrigan's only loss is to 10th-ranked Class 5A West Des Moines Valley, 58-54 in the last game of the regular season. The Golden Bears are led by All-State sophomore duo of Audie Crooks and Molly Joyce. Crooks, who set the state's all-time scoring record for a freshman, is averaging a double-double with 20.3 points and 10.1 rebounds per game. Joyce is scoring at 18.5 point clip. Senior Kalen Myers, a Grandview University recruit, is averaging 10.7. Comets have won four straight and are led by Allison Engel at 16 points per game and Chloe Walters at 14.4. Meanwhile, Emmitsburg, 15-8, will face Rock Valley, 15-9, in a Class 2A Region 7 championship. That contest will be at Hartley-Melvin-Sanborn High School. Tip is set for 7 o'clock. The Ehawks have won three straight and six of their last seven. Senior Abby Shanny is averaging 15.8 points per game. Senior Maddie Muller is scoring at a 10.8 point clip. The Rockets are on a five-game win streak. Rock Valley is led by senior Abby Heemstra at 16.6 points per game and classmate Lexus Van Kirkkerex, who is scoring 16.5 points per game. Take a quick look at some of the other sports stories. Kyle McKenzie continued to add to his resume, setting a new pool record. Saturday at Brookings, South Dakota, at a dual meet with South Dakota State, McKenzie broke the 400 individual medley record at the Stanley J. Marshall Center Pool, which has been used for 11 years. He finished in 4.06.38 seconds, winning by 12 seconds. Let's try that again. He finished in 4 minutes, 6.38 seconds, winning by 12 seconds. The victory was 1-3 for McKenzie on the day as teammate Jonathan Turner matched him with the three first-place finishes. McKenzie also won the 100 breaststroke, the 200 breaststroke. He claimed the 50 free, the 100 free, and the 100 butterfly. Turner claimed those victories, 50 free, 100 free, 100 butterfly. Andrew Iverson was first in the 1,000, finishing ahead of the runner-up by 8 seconds and bettering his time best time by 13 seconds. Tiered Van Stein added a gold in the 200 backstroke. Kyle's time is the third best on our school's top 10 list, said Iowa Central head coach Joe Plain, and Andrew's 1,000 free is his best ever non-tapered time. Second place finishes came courtesy of Van Stein in the 100 back, Gerard Gispert, 200 free, Javier Santiago in the 200 butterfly, and Magali Mouton in the 200 breaststroke. Lexi Mass was third in the 100 backstroke. Mountain third in the 100 breaststroke. The men's medley also finished third. We had a very good 2 weeks of practice, with this past week being very hard. The kids stepped up and competed well against Division I competition. Tritons compete next at Barton on Saturday, March 6. For the 16th consecutive year, the Iowa Central men walked out of the Region 11 Indoor Championships with a team title. The Tritons won 9 events and finished 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in 2 to easily place ahead of Iowa Western in the team standings. Iowa Central racked up 185 points, with the Rivers recording 115, followed by Indian Hills, Hawkeye, North Iowa Area, Southwestern, and Southeastern. Iowa Western did unseat the Triton women as their run of 15 consecutive regional titles ended with a 2nd place showing. Hawkeye, Indian Hills, Nyack, Southwestern, and Southeastern rounded out the field. 4 more national qualifiers secured spots at the NJCAA Indoor Championships in Noah Frisky in the 1,000, the 4x400 men's relay, Odell Fry in the 200, and Chloe Lenore in the mile. The Tritons also set a new regional meet, with Fry clocking a 7.42 to win the 60. Iowa Western had 4 regional meet records from Diana Gray in the 60 hurdles, Nikisha Price in both the 200 and 400, and Aliyah McNeil in the high jump. Jaheim Hales in the 60 hurdles, Fry in the 60, and Lenore in the mile racked the Iowa Central top 11 for top times. It was a great day and a great tune-up for our men's program, said Iowa Central coach Dee Brown. It was exciting for them to win their 16th championship in a row and grab a bunch of personal records. Our women are disappointed about the loss, but the most important meet of the season is still 2 weeks away. We have some time to get stronger and healthier and really put up some big points on the board. Hats off to the Iowa Western women, who really showed up and competed like champions. On the men's side for the Tritons, James McKay Jr. won the shot putt, Tristan Hanna the triple jump, David Bosque-Gramado the high jump, Jared Henderson the weight throw, Hales the 60 hurdles, Calvin Bungie the mile, Lee Eppy the 400, Nicola Paletti the pole vault, and Adam Gruen the 800. Fry was first in the 60, Victoria Adu the weight throw, and Lenore the mile run. Runner-up finishes came courtesy of Elliot Cummings in the triple jump, Ari Scott in the high jump and pole vault, Deschanel Dyer in the 60 hurdles, Robin Aguilar Gonzalez in the 1,000, and the 4x400 relay. Scott in the long jump, Enoch and Twee in the triple jump, Paletti in the high jump, and the men's distance medley were all third. Adu was second in the shot putt, and Fry runner-up in the 200, Madison Johnson in the high jump, Lilia Alvarez in the 1,000, Patience Heath the 800, and the women's distance medley relay all placed second. The NJCAA Men's and Women Indoor Track and Field Championships are scheduled for March 5th and 6th in Pittsburgh, Kansas, from the Robert W. Plaster Center. We'll take a look next at the sports section from the Webster City Daily Freeman Journal. Third verse, same as the first, the second one too for that matter. No matter how you try to spin it or dissect it, Humboldt is simply a bad matchup for Webster City, a fact that was proven yet again in the third meeting of the season on Monday in a Class 3A Substate 2 quarterfinal round contest. Multiple offensive flurries, a 20-2 burst in the first half, followed by a 13-0 spurt in the second half, turned the postseason affair into a blowout as Humboldt Webster City yet again 78-45 to advance to the Substate semifinals. The Wildcats 14-7 will face Algona 16-6 on Thursday. They outscored Webster City by 75 points this season, an average of 25 points per game. Two of those confrontations were decided by 33 and 32 points, the Lynx's two worst losses of the season. "They create such a nightmare matchup for us," said Webster City head coach Marty McKinney. Following Monday's setback, "I know they had some nights where they haven't played the greatest, but I've watched them multiple times along with playing them three times, and they're good. For whatever reason, the basket appears to be as big as the ocean for Humboldt when it steps onto the floor with Webster City. The Wildcats shot 65%, 31 of 48, including 62% from behind the three-point arc for 8 of 13 shooting on Monday. Throw the three-game series together, and are you ready for this? Humboldt shot 68% overall and 58% from 3 points. Webster City attempted to thwart Wildcats' outside bombers with pressure, man-to-man defense, but that left the Lynx vulnerable inside, and Humboldt forward Sam Fisher took advantage with a game-high 16 points. After knocking down just two threes in the first half, Humboldt erupted for six over the final 16 minutes. Will Ornes splashed in four for all 12 of his points, and Trevor Jacobson canned three and routed 2 of 12 more points. Throw in Caden Mattson's driving ability, which led to 15 points, and Webster City simply had no chance. "The couple of times we played them in the regular season, we played zone and they hit some shots," McKinney said. "So we thought our best matchup was man-to-man to try to make their shooters put on the floor and hope we could handle things inside. But Fisher is good. He made some nice moves. He's smooth and he can finish with both hands. And then he hit some threes in the second half." The game got away from Webster City over the stretch of 9 minutes and 18 seconds in the first half when Humboldt stepped on the accelerator. The Wildcats finished the first period on a 13-2 burst and then scored the opening 7 points in the second to push their lead to 29-11. A Tyler Olsen bucket from the right block ended Humboldt's 9-0 run with a minute 15 to go in the first, but the Lynx then went more than 7 minutes before they scored again. Trey Lyons finally ended the futility with another basket from the paint. Turnovers, not a lot, but just enough to change the complexion of the game, and Humboldt's ability to score in transition left Webster City in the rearview mirror. "We knew we really had to play a clean game offensively where we were limited possessions and we had limited turnovers," McKinney said. "I don't think we had a lot in the first half, but the ones we had, they capitalized on. At times defensively, we weren't too bad, but offensively, we struggled. They are very physical, and that's something we know we've got to be better at moving forward. Webster City connected on 41% of its shots, but was a dismal 2 of 17 for 12% from three-point land. Down by 15, 33-18 at the half, Webster City got as close as 11, following a tie McKinney 3 from the wing early in the third quarter. But Humboldt again answered with a haymaker, 13 straight points over the next 3 minutes, 35 seconds, and increased its advantage to 24 points, 57-33, entering the fourth period. Olson, one of three seniors on the Lynx roster, scored 13 points to go along with 4 rebounds, 2 assists, and 2 steals. Jamin Sturr added 10 and 5 boards on the inside, while Ty McKinney had 8 and Tavis Eklund 7. McKinney also registered 3 rebounds, 3 assists, and 3 steals. The senior class of Olson, Eklund, and Lyons may not have had the type of success it wanted this winter, but McKinney says the trio represented the school and the program the right way. "It's a great group of kids," he said. "No matter what the result was on Monday and even all season, I'll vouch for all 3 of those kids any day. They're fun to be around, and they battled through a tough season. I'm very proud to be a part of their lives and to have been able to coach them." We'll head back to the Messenger Sports, and we'll sum up the Fort Dodge Wrestling trip to the state tournament from this past weekend. Fort Dodge Wrestling team extended their recent medal barrage on Saturday as the Dodgers brought home 6 more from the state meet. This is the 7th straight year the Dodgers have captured 5 or more medals. The program's six straight top 3 finishes ended as Fort Dodge took 6 with 90.5 points. Waverly Shellrock was team champion, followed by Waukee and Southeast Polk. "Best thing I could take out of this was simply watching my kids," said head coach Bobby Thompson. "The chemistry through the wins and losses, the bond these guys have with the qualifiers and non-qualifiers. That's what Fort Dodge Wrestling is all about." Senior Lane Cowell at 120 was 4th. Freshman Drew Ayala at 106 was 5th. Senior Cody Cook at 160 was 7th. Sophomore Max Bishop was 8th place at 113 and had to have a couple of injury forfeits. "We had some really positive moments," Thompson said. "There's some matches that we wish we could get back. I thought we performed well, but didn't quite get the results we wanted." Cal advanced to the 120-pound consolation final with 11-3 major decision over Johnston's number 5, Reiner Stahlbaum. Cal, who is 102-29 in his career, suffered a 6-2 setback to defending champion Bailey Roybal of Waverly Shellrock for 3rd. "It means a lot to be a Dodger," Cowell said. "Putting on that logo for the last time was emotional. I was aiming for 1st this year, and I worked my tail off for a long time for this, so I'm not really thinking about how I placed 3 times. I wanted to be a champ. That's it." After losing to 3rd-ranked Chad Ballas at 24-2 of Dubuque Hempstead, who was the state runner-up, Cowell won 3 straight matches, also knocking off number 6 Jace Luna of Bettendorf. Lane is now a 3-time medalist and finished his career strong, Thompson said. "Lane wrestled a great tournament. He lost 2 tough matches in a bracket with a tough draw. He started on JV and laid it all on the line to get better." In his first season on the mat, 4th-ranked Ayala, 31-6, reached the semifinals at 106, losing a heartbreaker to top-ranked Carter Freeman of Waukee. "It was a great season. I fell a little short, but I'll be back next year. It was nice to have the seniors there with me during the journey. They are great role models and helped me with everything." In the consolation semifinals, Ayala lost to number 2 Kyler Kostafin of Dowling. He bounced back with a 10-3 victory over 7th-ranked Zane Behrens of Waverly Shellrock. It was Ayala's 2nd victory over Behrens in the tournament. "Drew is 100% committed," said Thompson, who is an uncle to Ayala. "He didn't get what he wanted, but he has the drive to get better. You can see it in his eyes." Cook won his final match of his career by medical forfeit over Tristan Sales of Burlington. A 3-time qualifier and a 2-time medalist, he took 6th a year ago, finishing with a career mark of 87-48. "Finishing with 2 medals is a big accomplishment. I will cherish the memories I have on the team forever. Being a Dodger means fighting until the end and going out there and representing your community in any sport or activity that you are in. 160-pounder had a 5-1 victory over Sean Mwangi of Waverly Shell Rock in a 13-3 major decision over Max Derry of Dowling. Cody was another guy like Lane and Drazon who started wrestling as a sophomore. He qualified as a sophomore and then wrestled lights out as a junior. These seniors will be seriously missed with 11 medals between them. Bishop, a state qualifier a year ago, suffered an ankle injury in the 113-pound Constellations. I'm not feeling the best, and I wanted to wrestle my match, but I just couldn't stand on it, Bishop said. Building on this is just going to push me to get higher on that podium and closer to that title that's mine. The fifth-ranked sophomore opened the tournament with a 16-0 tech fall over Jack Stevens at Clear Creek Amana and a 2-1 win over number 6 Hunter Callis of Cedar Rapids Prairie in the blood round. Bishop is 53-19 in his two seasons. Max showed maturity, growth. It's good to see him get a medal. Thompson said, at this level, injuries happen. It will make him hungrier. Let's take a quick look at the forecast. A lot of sunshine. In fact, I don't see, there's a chance of clouds on Thursday. So cloudy on Thursday, high of 35. But after that, sunshine is predicted for the next 7 days. 35, partly sunny on Friday. 43 and sunny on Saturday. 34, partly sunny on Sunday. 35 and sunny on Monday. 39 on Tuesday. 44 Wednesday, 44 Thursday under mostly sunny skies. Friday, a high of 48 degrees, woo-hoo, under partly cloudy skies. No snow, no precipitation of any form is shown to be in the forecast. That will bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, February 24th. I'm Kevin Rogers here at the microphone. Thanks so much for joining me for this time. Hope you enjoy this podcast and the many other podcasts that are available at the iowaradioreading.org website, iowaradioreading.org. So much enjoying the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger with you folks here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Thank you so much for joining me, and we'll talk to you again real soon here on IRIS. Bye-bye for now.